Hi there, welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host for today, Carla Nappi. I recently had a great time talking with Kyle Stanford about his book, Exceeding Our Grasp, Science, History, and the Problem of Unconceived Alternatives. Now, that first came out with Oxford University Press in 2006, but it was then re-released as a paperback in 2010, and it's the paperback that we spent time talking about. This is a book that explores a question that seems very simple, but that's actually fundamental to not just the scholarly study of science, including its philosophical and historical and sociological aspects, but also to understanding what it means to live in a world that is really kind of full of, and in many ways, the ramifications of the way that we venerate the authority of science. And that question is, essentially, should we really believe what our best scientific theories say about the otherwise inaccessible parts of the world they seek to describe? And this is a question posed by Stanford in the book. Now, the book goes on to explore the question of and varieties of what we might call scientific realism and its alternatives in a really interesting way that I think is particularly fascinating for anyone interested in innovative ways of combining the history and philosophy of science. It's really interesting. We had a great time talking about it, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're here today to talk with Kyle Stanford about his book, Exceeding Our Grasp, Science, History, and the Problem of Unconceived Alternatives. Now, that first came out with Oxford University Press in 2006, but it just came out only a couple years ago as a paperback, and so this is an occasion for us to get together over Skype and talk about what I found to be a really stimulating, really fascinating book, and I think one that's of special interest and special importance to the field of STS, and just that shows a really broad interdisciplinary range in its subject matter and in its mode of presentation. So thanks so much, Kyle, for the book and for making time to talk with us about it today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Great. So can you start us off sort of broadly by saying a little bit about what brought you into the field? How did you decide to, I know this is a broad question and we're probably having to look back quite a ways, but what got you interested in philosophy of science in the first place?
It's actually strangely easy to answer in this context because it was my first contact with the issue of scientific realism, which is a lot of what the book is about, in college that first drew me into the philosophy of science. I was really blown away by the like everybody else, I'd sort of taken the grasp or the picture of various domains of nature that you get from theoretical natural science at face value, learning them in earlier parts of my education. And that was it was sort of a mind-blowing experience to suddenly be thinking about arguments that all of that might have been too hasty. And so it's funny, in graduate school, I worried about many things that were very different. My dissertation has nothing to do with the book.
Really? But then,
yeah, nothing. It was on the theory of causation, but I came back to, I mean, I worried about these kinds of questions a fair bit, partly because I was in the science studies program at UCSD, but it wasn't sort of the central focus of my work. When I started teaching intro philosophy of science courses again, it bugged me more and more and more, and I sort of figured out that that's what I had something to say about that I couldn't stop working on. So the book really grew out of the same thing that got me into philosophy of science in the first place.
That's fascinating. And you had did you take your dissertation on causation, and where did that go? Did that become articles? Did you just decide to move on from that? Or
some parts of it became articles. Parts of it were on Hume and the history of philosophy, and a couple of parts of it did that way. But actually, the central machinery. The central proposal, I was very enthusiastic about, and I still think it's roughly right. But I had a reviewer raise some objections to it in paper format that I didn't really have good answers to, mm-hmm. And so I stopped trying to publish it at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I
It just sounds like there's something very freeing about that. I mean, that just sounds actually fantastic from Rosie.
There wasn't any big moral virtue at the time. The decision I actually made was, I will have to think about this more and see if I think there are answers to these questions. And not attempting to have it published anymore came out of the fact of not finding answers to those questions. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, between then and now, I've changed a lot in my views of sort of how philosophical issues are most productively approached. So even if I were to go back to that kind of thing, I wouldn't do it in the way that I did then anyway. So that's been also part of why it doesn't hurt so much to lose my baby, that I now would think of things in different ways than I did then.
Right. Well, the book that did come out of this for your first is wonderful, and that's let's get right into that. I've already sort of briefly mentioned this at the beginning. We talked a little bit about this before we started recording the interview, but one of the really notable things about this book, before we actually get into the meat and potatoes of it, and one of the things that really grabbed me. The title is Exceeding Our Grasp, so that wasn't a pun, but maybe sort of. It's some area of my mind. The thing that really grabbed me is your, I think, very successful attempt in this book to meaningfully bring together the history of science and the philosophy of science. This isn't a book that just cherry picks one famous book about one famous case, about one, famous scientific discovery, and uses that as the basis from which to expand out and theorize. This is a book that does serious work in primary and secondary literature in, a bunch of different cases in the history of science, and in particularly the history of biological sciences. I would love to hear a little bit more, if you wouldn't mind talking about it, about that approach. What kind of brought you into a kind of topic and a kind of way of working out a topic that brought you so deeply into engagement with the historical record, and in a very meaningful way, from my perspective as a historian of science, not in at all a superficial way. So can you talk about that transdisciplinarity?
Sure, and I'm delighted to hear your, that reaction. So there are kind of two different ways in which that was motivated. The most important, I suppose, is internal to the project. What the central question that the book is worrying about is this very longstanding issue of scientific realism. That is to say, whether we should take the descriptions given by our best scientific theories of otherwise inaccessible parts of nature as straightforward descriptions of what's really there in areas that are hard to get access to otherwise, or if we should see them in some other way. And, I mean, that's been a philosophical issue on which people taken the history of science to bear, right, and philosophers of science have made a extensive use of the historical record in trying to address that question, especially in the late 60s and 70s and into the 80s when the marriage of history and philosophy of science was kind of new, I think largely in the as a result of Thomas Kuhn's work and the structure of scientific revolutions. But and so there's been this sort of very productive and useful marriage, but I think especially, I mean, that in that generation of philosophers of science, the use did tend to be in the way that you were just suggesting. There would be a sort of, we'd sort of take advantage of the potted histories of sciences, and there were a couple sort of really well recycled examples that would be adverted to again and again, phlogiston and the ether and caloric. Not that I don't talk about those examples, but it did seem to me part of what one would want in part of what the book seeks to do is make an historical case that raises problems for the scientific realist view in a way that I think hadn't really been done before. And one thing I wanted to do was it argues that the positive, the affirmative reasons we have for doubting the realist view, the evidence for those comes from the historical record. And it seemed to me that if you wanted to make that case, the best place to make it was where people thought it would be hardest to make, and that was in the biological sciences, right? There tends to be this very field-specific differences in how plausible people find scientific realism or alternatives to it. And for interesting and not crazy reasons, biologists and philosophers of biology are some of the most unrepentant realists, scientists and philosophers around, by contrast with, say, theoretical physicists or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so what I wanted to do was, in the book, there are several chapters that treat a detailed succession of theories of what would have been called at the time theories of generation. We would call them theories of inheritance. And it would package up a couple of different things into growth and embryology and repair, and I wanted to both tackle and show that the general case I was suggesting on historical grounds could be supported both within the biological sciences, where people tend to think it would be hard to do, as opposed to mathematized physics, and also for comparatively recent science. So it deals with those theories of inheritance and generation in the second half of the 19th century, theories that are pretty close to, pretty continuous with contemporary theories, and yet in ways that really matter to the argument, also quite different from what we now believe.
So as we're still setting the stage, we'll get into the chapters in a few moments, and you look at the case studies in particular that focus on Darwin, Galton, and Weismann. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting hearing about the sort of justifications that went into focusing on this particular field and this perhaps this particular subset of the field. Can you say a little bit about how you then, once you identify that you wanted to work on something that we might consider to be within the history of the biological sciences, right? Even though, I know that I'm being anachronistic by even saying that, and, let's just, we can all agree on that and then move on. You decided to not just work on that, but why the problems of, I guess we'll start there, why the problems of inheritance and genesis in particular, and related to that, at what point or how did you feel comfortable that it was going to be possible to generalize from this particular set of theories and this kind, though the way that a theory is worked out in the historical documents that you look at, to mm-hmm. something that's more broadly constitutive of scientific theorization, broadly read?
So yeah, that's a great question. Let me kind of answer it backwards.
Sure.
Part of the motivation was purely opportunistic, right? I saw a nicely organized succession of theories where I thought the phenomenon that I was talking about, which I do think of as quite general, mm-hmm. Was on especially clear display. Mm-hmm. And so I could make the case there. But really, the way that the argument sets up in the book, I sort of first motivate the claim that this is a general phenomenon, which is not to say that it applies to all scientific claims of all sorts or it applies to all scientific theories. What the limits are is something I've been thinking about more lately. But I first motivate the case by gesturing at, right, in sort of the old-fashioned way, a long list of successions of theories in the history of science that I think exemplify the same pattern, right? So I say that this is the pattern we have in the study of mechanics from Aristotle to Descartes to Newton to Einstein. I ultimately wind up considering a sort of package of objections mm-hmm. to thinking of this as the general pattern we're finding out there. And it turns out, I think you can't answer those objections without doing the details. Mm-hmm. And so that's what motivated me to want to plunge into the details in at least one set of cases. Mm-hmm. And this seemed both to me opportunistically, a place where I could really make a strong case, but also where the case would be especially effective, right? People have sort of done the examples that I gestured at in lots and lots of cases. And so I wanted to be trying it on a new set of example, trying to make the case that it was a new set of examples and that it applied even there. So in a way, it was supposed to support it, as opposed to saying, here's something that's happening in a very detailed set of for a very specific set of theories, mm-hmm. and I claim this happens everywhere, mm-hmm. right? I use some broad historical examples to suggest that this is not something that happens everywhere, but happens quite widely in science. The problem is a problem we have to worry about quite widely in science. Mm-hmm. And then I used the specifics of this case to try to rebut what seemed to me very natural and reasons for maybe some skepticism that that's what's really going on. And it couldn't answer those that sort of skepticism without engaging in the details. It's been really nice, actually. You just said a bunch of really wonderful and complimentary things about how the book struck you. It's one of the things that's been really gratifying since I went back and did this sort of in the trenches historical work is for lots of historians of science, particularly some of the earlier generation historians of science who've worked on, especially guys who did it, people who did it in biology, coming and saying how much they liked the book and how pleased they were to see real integration between the history and philosophy of science. Again, two fields which in more recent years have drifted a little bit apart from the way they were a few decades ago. I think that the history and philosophy of science still have an awful lot to offer one another, and there are some, trends and fashions in the disciplines that are making that a little harder now than they used to be.
Absolutely. And I think some, and then we'll get into the argument here, but I think one of the things also, at least in my experience, trying to be involved in ways to bring together discussions of history and philosophy of science, or rather discussions among historians and philosophers of science, which is more to the point, it can be difficult not only because of the kinds of questions that we're asking in these respective fields, but also in the way that questions tend to be asked and responded to, right? I mean, I think at least if I remember briefly one case and when I was in grad school and there was a workshop in my graduate program that explicitly tried to do this. And one of the things that repeatedly happened was, philosophers saying, here's a challenge that I'm going to raise to you. And then, a historian would be like, but what about this? And then it was attack. And the historians were just not used to this kind of rhetoric of, attack, attack, attack. Let's go out for a beer. It's all good. I think just the rhetoric of disciplinary discussion is so different that's, again, one of the really great things about this book in particular is that you've somehow managed to speak to both disciplinary fields in ways that I think, at least as a historian of science, it feels very convincing to me. It's not, it's a very convincing marriage here. So
I appreciate that. It made it easier that, right, in this case anyway, I truly believe that the historical details are what the affirmative argument stands on. So I couldn't sort of afford to treat history in this, give it the back of my hand sort of way. But it was very satisfying to me personally to be able to do that and sort of create what I thought. I mean, it's your book; you get to write it the way you want, mm-hmm. and to set up a way that it seemed to me that the history and philosophy of science could productively interact rather than running into the kind of things that you're talking about.
Absolutely. So let's get right into it. The book opens up by posing an issue that you've already, I think, very elegantly mentioned for us, which is this issue of should we really believe what our best scientific theories say about the world, about the parts of the world they seek to describe, both those that are observable and those that are not observable, right? And this issue of observability itself will come up later on, but should we believe this? So, ultimately, at various stages of the argument, in really interesting ways, this issue of believability and trust, and then what we should practice or enact based on that comes up, right? So this isn't a book, and this isn't an argument as I read it that's just about, is it this way or is it that way? It's about sort of what can we be justified in basing our practices and actions upon, given. So it's not just about, is this right or is this right? So I think I thought that was very, very useful. So you lay out here the position of scientific realism. So I'll just sort of briefly state that and then ask you to elaborate on some of the major issues that come out of that. So realism being roughly the central claims of our best scientific theories have some relationship, or they're probably true in the simplest form, right? So the central claims of our best scientific theories are probably true accounts of what's actually out there in nature. So this is one of the things the book is going to do from here on out, is to repeatedly engage with this idea and various instantiations of the idea of scientific realism, and sort of present an alternative, right, to thinking up, to taking seriously the things that we can do with and the ways that we can use scientific ideas without necessarily having to believe that they are true representations of nature and then act based on that. Okay. So there's our baseline. So you raise two major concepts in this chapter, in the first chapter, that are going to go on to be central for the rest of the book. One of them is the idea of what you call the pessimistic induction. So for listeners who have no idea what the pessimistic induction is, can you just briefly explain what that is and why that's important?
Sure. It's a great place to start, because my guess is that there will be many listeners who are wondering if we can really mean what we're saying here when we raise the prospect that what our scientific theories seem to tell us about the world out there isn't actually true. Who could possibly think that? And the pessimistic induction is a really good way to start seeing how that kind of view might not be as crazy as it sounds. The pessimistic induction is actually a really simple argument. It's been around for a long time, more than 100 years. Poincaré is one of the people who raised it very eloquently in the first place. But it simply goes as follows. Our reason typically given for believing that our best scientific theories do tell us what things are like in remote parts of the universe, in very tiny parts of the world, other difficult to get access to areas, is the success that we have using them, right? Predicting, guiding our interventions into nature, and all the rest of it. And yet, thinkers like Poincaré noted, right, the previous theories have had lots of success of the same basic sorts, have allowed us to predict and intervene successfully, and yet have turned out to be fundamentally mistaken in their picture of whatever part of the natural world they were attempting to describe. And so you might think of it as a challenge posed this way. Why should we think that our current successful theories are going to last forever and not ultimately be overturned and replaced by something that's fundamentally or radically different in its basic claims about nature, in the way that, you know, the claims of general relativity about the character of gravitational force, it's the deformation of, it comes from the deformation of space-time. It's not a force at all, as it is in Newtonian mechanics, right? That's a radical difference in the descriptive claim about nature. Why would we think, right, just on the basis of the successes they've enjoyed, that we're now at the end of that process of theory replacement and theories enjoying successes but ultimately being overturned, right? So that's the sense in which it's an induction. It's an induction from the what's happened in all the past cases to what there is probably going to happen in the present case. And it's pessimistic, of course, because it gives us this conclusion that we may not have as much knowledge about the natural world as we think we do.
Great, thank you. Okay, so we've got the pessimistic induction, and then we move to another idea that's going to be that's going to provide a baseline for everything that comes after, and this is the idea of the underdetermination of theories by evidence. So what is the underdetermination of theories by evidence, and why is that important?
So this is another sort of long-standing line of argument that people have used to try to make trouble for scientific realism. And the idea is, well, okay, you've got a scientific theory, and it's has a bunch of evidence that's supporting it. But, of course, there could be another theory, an alternative theory, a fundamentally different theory that was equally well-supported, or at least well-supported, by that very same data, that very same body of evidence. In that case, what you'd want to, so underdetermination is just a term of art. and this is the way you'd use it, that body of evidence underdetermines our theory choice. It doesn't tell us which theory to pick. Mm-hmm. And so the debate among philosophers of science for years and years has been about whether we ought to really think that there are such alternative theories against which our evidence underdetermines the choice. And so traditionally, philosophers have worked on coming up with kind of unconvincing examples, alternatives that don't really look like the scientific theories we know and love, and the debate about underdetermination in that way kind of gets off the rails. But the basic idea is just the idea that one and the same body of evidence could provide compelling support for more than one theoretical possibility.
Great. Now, one of the things that then this chapter goes on to do, and again, this is going to be foundational, is you're showing us persistent problems, or some persistent problems with both of these ideas, both the idea of pessimistic induction and the idea of underdetermination. Now, one of the things that's really interesting in here for, I think for scholars of STS more broadly, and so I'm going to try to focus on those moments where I can in the discussion, is you raise the issue that some of the problems with these ideas might be based on the fact that philosophers developing these ideas are focusing primarily on examples from the physical sciences, right? And so in some way, it's the choice of historical examples that's actually determining, you know, part of what the philosophy looks like. In the case of problems with these two ideas, can you talk a little bit about that? Because it does get at basic methodological issues that I think are very common to anyone working on science studies, and that is the issue of how to sort of extrapolate from a particular case and here a particular field of the sciences more broadly to the sciences in general, which, you know, some would argue are so heterogeneous that there's no there, right? So can you say a little bit about that?
Sure, that's a great place to put your finger for the thing to put your finger on for the issue that you're worried about, because one of the lines of argument among philosophers of science who have thought worries about underdetermination are overblown is a suggestion that, look, this is kind of an artifact of modern mathematized physical theories, a philosopher named Larry Loudon has gone so far, writing with Jarrett Leplin, has gone so far as to say all of the convincing examples of underdetermination always involve the relativity of motion. And so if you think that, then you think this is a very restricted phenomenon, and it would be a huge mistake to say, hey, look at this thing that happens in you know, highly abstract mathematized physical theories. Wow, all of science is probably like that. And it's even the case in recent years, but even more broadly than just the idea that we may be finding things that are specific to particular areas of science and overgeneralizing. Even something like the pessimistic induction itself, people have worried about, well, if you're just going through and picking examples where this thing happens, you're ignoring the cases where it doesn't happen or something like that, right? We're ignoring the kind of methodology we would insist on in science itself for making sure that our evidence is representative, for making sure that we're, right, considering a representative sample of past scientific theories and deciding what to think about present ones and stuff like that. So this question about representativeness and how and if we should be extrapolating arises in the details of trying to decide how compelling some of these arguments are. It seems to me, I actually think the case concerning underdetermination, the case that it's easy to generate in mathematized physical theories for reasons that probably don't generalize everywhere and all the time, I think that case is actually has been pretty convincingly made. And so it's not that I mean, so I'm worried about underdetermination of a different kind, but the part of what's happened is philosophers of science have tended to obsess on about the kinds of underdetermination they can prove to obtain, and that seems to arise, right? So in this physical science context.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we move on from this to a section in which you're going to raise the sort of one of the central ideas now that we're going to be developing over the course of the rest of the book. And this is the idea of sort of the worry of the problem of unconceived alternatives. Okay. This is a proposition that, or a problem that is fundamental to understanding what your argument's going to be about each of the three case studies that are going to come later, the Darwin case study, the Galton, and the Weissmann. So, since this is such a huge part of the book, what is the problem of unconceived alternatives and why is this so important? Why do we need to worry about this?
Well, my suggestion is, I think that, as I say in the first chapter, I think there are convincing responses that at least generate a tie or a situation where we ought not be sure what to believe in the case of arguments both from pessimistic induction and from underdetermination, but that there's a grain of truth in both of them that is connected to this further problem that hasn't quite been articulated, right? So the suggestion is this. If there's a kind of underdetermination that we seriously need to worry about, right, that we have good grounds for worrying about, it is underdetermination of our choice of current theories by the evidence we have supporting them against alternative theoretical possibilities that are fundamentally different that we haven't even conceived of yet, right? That are not in the what I call the eliminative competition among theories right now, right? In the way that if you think back to, say, right, the triumphant 200 years of Newtonian mechanics dominating physical science, it's not that, you know, anybody thought of general relativity and said, no, that's not as well supported or any such thing. Nobody had thought of it yet. And so I think if there's a real underdetermination worry, it's not the kinds of examples philosophers have taken so far. It's this underdetermination by unconceived alternative theoretical possibilities. If there's a reason to take that possibility seriously and think that, yes, that's actually the situation we're in, it's the historical record. So the historical record provides the evidence that makes us take the prospect of underdetermination by unconceived alternatives seriously and think, hey, yeah, that's probably the situation that we're in because it's the situation that historically theorists have been in over and over again, right? What we learn from history, I think, is that we're not very good at exhausting a space of theoretical alternatives that are well supported by a given body of evidence. And why would you call that a problem of unconceived alternatives? Well, it's a problem for scientific realism because if you think that our current theories, well supported as they are by the evidence we have, are only the best supported of the things we've thought of so far, but that there are probably lots of theoretical alternatives out there we haven't even thought to try out and test against them, well, then your confidence in the truth of contemporary scientific theories is under challenge.
So the first thing, well, so there are two things immediately that come to mind to mention, or that I wanted to mention eventually from what you just said. The first is the ambitiousness of this theory, right? I mean, you're really making a claim here about the nature of human thought or nature of cognition and its limitations in some way. This isn't just about the history of science. This is, at least in moments of the book, about something more broad that has something to do not just what people have done, but what it's possible for a human being in a situation where of scientific theorization to do. So on the one hand, it's the ambition of this theory. On the other hand, or not on the other hand, but another thing immediately that somebody in hearing you say this would ask would be, okay, so tell me about how you look in the historical record for a lack, right? How do you look in the historical record methodologically for an absence of something? Because it sounds like, right, what we're looking for then is a failure on the part of a historical actor to conceive of a possible alternative to that theory. So especially in the case of the latter point, can you talk a little bit about that? What does it mean and what does it look like for you to use the historical record to find evidence of an unconceived alternative?
Sure. So yeah, let me address both of those things. One thing, I mean, there is a sense in which the argument of the book is extraordinarily ambitious in a really old-fashioned way. I mean, one thing that we all, right, all of we sophisticated professionals these days realize is, you know, how different the different areas of science are, and probably there isn't going to be anything you can say about all of them that applies. And this, in a way, is atavistic in that I make this very general argument. On the other hand, there are some things to say in defense of that ambition. One is what I'm really creating. What I really suggest there's a worry about or a problem for is a kind of reasoning or a kind of inference that you might call eliminative. It's when you're eliminating possibilities and believing what's left over. Right. So one thing to note is, I'm only really so I don't want to suggest, and I try to say carefully in the book, look, this isn't a problem for all of science, because not all of science makes use of this kind of eliminative inference. It does seem to be especially important in those cases where we're trying to justify or decide whether to believe what we think of as especially theoretical science, mm-hmm. but that's not all that science does. Mm-hmm. And so it's really, there's a thing to worry about in the case of eliminative inferences, which are much broader than science and not, so we engage in eliminative inferences all over the place. And it's not what all of science does either. But the interesting thing is, there's one way of thinking about the argument of the book is that I'm arguing that eliminative inference is a very strong, very powerful, useful kind of inference. We use it all the time in everyday contexts everywhere. When we use it in science, we're using it in a way, in a place that it is risky, in a way that we don't appreciate. Because in everyday everyday contexts, mm-hmm. right? It was somebody else who lives in my house who did this. Now, which one of them was it? There's a background assumption that's satisfied, which is that we have a pretty good grasp of all the possible alternatives. And one way to think of the suggestion is, wow, science is a place, theoretical science is a place where very often that presumption isn't satisfied. And so we're taking a very powerful, useful tool that has a broad reliability and putting it to work in a context where the assumptions needed for its reliability to hold up aren't satisfied. And so there's a way in which the argument's very ambitious in that way, right? It sort of applies to everything, but also in which it has to be sort of carefully constrained what it is that actually creates trouble for, which isn't all of science. But to the second part of your question, right? So suppose you're trying to convince somebody this really is a problem for at least lots of theoretical science or lots of scientific claims that have been made or scientific theories that have been advanced. How do you show that? How do you show that these alternatives really are all over the place? By hypothesis, we're talking, in the present case, we're talking about alternative theories that haven't been conceived of. How do you show that those are sitting all over the place? Well, the strategy, right, is to go back into past cases and say, look, we have repeatedly in the past been in the position of only being able to conceive of one or a small number of theoretical possibilities well confirmed by this this body of evidence, whereas we now know that there were unconceived alternative possibilities available, present at the time, that nobody conceived of, right? And so, that, in a way, that's the biggest historical challenge, right? When you say, how do you go back and show that somebody didn't do something or that something never occurred to somebody? And that's actually where the details of the historical cases really matter, because it actually turns out to be interestingly different in the three cases that I discuss. In the case of Darwin, for example, what we find is a person who developed one of these fundamentally distinct conception of how inheritance and generation might work, trying to express his theory to Darwin. It's Francis Galton who's the person in question, right? Galton and Darwin were cousins, and they corresponded and were close. And you can see, and I show in the book from Darwin's letters, that he just doesn't understand the fundamental idea that Galton is trying to introduce him to, right? So that in a way was the best smoking gun I ever found, right? Was the actual alternative being presented to somebody with a going theory and positive evidence that he doesn't understand it. In other cases, I argue that, right, from in scientific writings, for instance, right, Weismann will say, well, right, this isn't true, so it has to be this other way because there's no alternative. Mm-hmm. And you can use that kind of claim to show, well, so here's this third alternative that would come along later, that people would suggest later, and we can go back and see, wow, that would have worked just as well, right? In part, we see those especially clearly when the alternative that's getting ignored is the one we ultimately come to embrace. That's not required, but it makes it particularly easy to see. And we say, so it's reasonable to infer that that possibility just never occurred to Weismann, or he wouldn't say this this otherwise silly eliminative thing, that it doesn't work in way X, so it has to work in way Y. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of different. It's heterogeneous. It's different in between the chapters, what I found in each case. And you know, it's fallible. Perhaps the case could be criticized on evidential grounds in any one of those cases. But I think the fun of that was going back and trying to find, because I didn't know how to show that before I dug into the cases. And I was hoping to find the kinds of things that would enable me to make a convincing argument that so-and-so didn't conceive of a given theory. It seems to me there's a kind of background plausibility to the idea that, you know, Aristotle never conceived of Newtonian mechanics, Newton never conceived of general relativity, right? People are likely to concede those claims. But there is this general worry, right? If you think these unconceived alternatives exist in some general way, you have to really be able to show that a theoretical alternative hadn't even been proposed or hadn't been part of the eliminative competition at all at a given earlier time. And so the historical details are how you show that.
Right. And because this is a great segue, there's a ton that we can talk about that's, you know, the really wonderful in these first two chapters. But because so much of what you're arguing here is about the details. It's about doing the hard work of getting into the historical documents and using the details to show and to build up this theory. Let's get right into those details and those cases. So for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, who I hope will have a chance after this if they haven't already, you give us three really wonderfully worked out case studies here. One is Darwin focusing on his idea of pangenesis. Then we move to Galton focusing on his idea of stirp, and we can or don't have to talk about what that means. And then Weismann's theory of germplasm. In the interest of time, we probably won't have time to talk about all of these, but can you choose just whichever one of these three cases is most interesting and fascinating to you and talk us through a little bit about, you know, talk us through the case a little bit and how this idea of unconceived alternatives plays out and how it helps us to understand this problem.
Sure. I will apologize to myself, if no one else, for not talking about the Weismann case, because there are ways, especially in our how we came to have our present conception of inheritance and development, that for which that case is really particularly interesting. But it's a little easier to quickly sketch in the case of the transition from Darwin to Galton. And so I'll talk about that real quick. The idea is this. So Darwin developed a theory of inheritance on which the parts of the adult body throw off little particles. He called them gemmules that accumulate in sexual sexually reproducing organisms they accumulate in the sex organs, right? And that was the material on which the body of the next, from which the body of the next generation was made. And he thought, right? This is by no means a quote. It's a general description of Darwin's thinking on the matter. How else could it be that offspring resemble their parents in so many detailed particular ways unless those detailed particular features of the parents were involved in some way in producing, causally involved in the production of those same traits in the offspring? Possibility that Darwin just never got his mind around, never considered, and couldn't recognize when it was presented to him by Galton, was the possibility of what we call a germline, right? In which, it's not that the features of the adult went, right, to the sex organs or whatever and then caused the features of the offspring, but instead they had a common source, right? There was a reproductive line that produced features in the adult and then went on to produce systematically related features in the offspring, right? And so it's important to notice what Darwin fails to conceive of isn't Galton's theory specifically, or even Weismann's theory specifically. It's a whole class of theories that were just not on his radar that would have appealed to this kind of common cause mechanism. And of course, again, it's easy to see because that's what we think really happens. And so, once it was proposed, once we did start investigating that possibility, we started thinking that's the way things really are. And later theories tend to be these common cause germline source of resemblances between parents and offspring. But it was an idea that Darwin just didn't have. And as I said before, a particularly nice historical case because really quite good evidence that he wasn't able to understand or recognize it when it was presented to him, right? And so that's the kind of thing that I mean by both evidence of and unconceived alternative theories. And yet and the important thing is the exclusion of these whole classes of theories from earlier thinking. That again, I think we have good reason to think every reason in the world to think is still going on.
Great. Thank you. Great, elegant, precise. So one of the things that that a reader might ask then is, okay, so what makes an alternative cluster of theories serious, right? Mm. Sort of, how do we identify, the sort of serious alternative clusters of theories that Darwin, for example, wasn't considering versus other possible clusters of theories that aren't serious and so shouldn't really factor in. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, this is actually a little bit surprisingly to me. This is something that some philosophers of science have raised a lot of trouble about because early in the book, I make a point of saying, look, we're not worried about these wild skeptical scenarios. There's an evil demon who's trying to trick us or something like that. That wasn't the problem. The problem was regular old scientific theories and that there might be more than one that's well confirmed by the evidence. Let's worry about that problem. And so people have come in and said, wait, though, to people in Newton's day, general relativity would have looked like a crazy idea, right? That wouldn't have seemed scientifically serious, maybe. And so that was part of the reason for focusing on the specific historical examples that I did. They are close enough in time to us, close enough in time to each other, that they wouldn't have been unrecognizable in that way. And so one thing I wanted to show with this bit of history is this happens even at this kind of more fine-grained scale of theories, just the theories in the second half of the 19th century or something like that, where you can't say, had Galton thought of Weismann's theory, he would have said, that's insane, right? That doesn't make any sense. But at the same time, right, the question, we're making this claim about an historical pattern that I think is still in place, you have to answer the question about how to delimit the scientifically serious possibilities we're worried about. And so in a way, that's something I finesse because I say, look, we're not worried about these crazy scenarios, but in the only sense that matters here, anything that's ultimately accepted by an actual scientific community has to count as scientifically serious, even if people at an earlier time wouldn't have thought so or would have rejected it as crazy or anything like that, right? Because, right, what we've seen is at least enough change in background beliefs and assumptions to make the that previously strange possibility not only be taken seriously, but ultimately be accepted, right, does happen in the course of scientific history. And so anything that that winds up actually getting accepted has to count as scientifically serious in the only sense that matters here. So it doesn't actually matter if Aristotelians would have said, no, that's crazy, right? It still falls within the range of a well-confirmed, regular old, plain vanilla, garden variety scientific hypothesis. Okay. And if ours, if our scientific hypotheses are underdetermined as against alternatives that are as different from our own as Einstein is from Newton, we can't say, well, we can afford not to take those seriously, because right, part of what history shows us is that that's well within the bounds of what we might have to take seriously.
And that's, I mean, as if listeners can't see this, but I'm nodding profusely here. This is, it seems to me, where it becomes really important that you're talking about, you're looking for cases in the actual historical record. You're not saying, you know, in some ideal world, this would count as a serious, you know, this is what a serious alternative looks like formally. You're saying, look, I'm showing you cases where I'm taking you through the argument, or I'm taking you through the process by which I'm going to show you that these people were presented by peers with the possibility of considering a serious alternative, an alternative that was considered serious by their peers or by some peers or by later peers, and they did not take that in. So this it seems to me that this is precisely where working with in a fine-grained way with historical detail and taking us through this as it unfolded really, really makes this point.
Thanks. I mean, I felt like that was the constraint I wanted to satisfy was, look, an automatic way to make sure we're talking about the kinds of alternatives that we ought to take seriously, that it would be an actual problem for contemporary theories if we're ignoring them. The way to, right, a constraint that can ensure that those possibilities are the ones we're worrying about is really this, well, it has to have been actually accepted by some actual scientific community at some point. You could even loosen that up and say it has to have been seriously entertained by some scientific community, right? That would do it too. It so happens, I think you can generate all the examples you want, even just sticking to theories that actually wound up being accepted by somebody. And so that does turn out to be the way that we make sure that we're talking about the kinds of examples that would really worry you and that are really a distinctive problem for theoretical natural science as opposed to knowledge claims of any kind or something like that.
Now, there's so much more happening in these three chapters in particular, and there's so much more in any of these cases we could talk about that we won't have time to right now. But one of the things that that's of particular interest potentially to STS, right, as a field, is the issue that you raise later on in these chapters, where you bring up a possible concern by a field that we acronymize, if that's a word, to SSK, the Sociology of Scientific Knowledge. And this is a problem of, you know, so where is there a space for the social in here? Or more broadly conceived, you could sort of extrapolate out to the question of how do we get from these three cases where you're showing this phenomenon or this problem of unconceived alternatives as it's manifest for basically three men, and how do we get from there to a story about communities? How do we get from there to a story about groups of scientists? And where is the root, where's the place, if at any, for the social and for the community in here? Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I think that's one of the things that would, you know, come up as a question for especially a social historian looking to this.
Sure. Well, I say some things early on in the book about what I think is and isn't convincing about the what we think of as the broad style of SSK arguments, argumentation, and the conclusions that sociologists of scientific knowledge have come to. The way it arises in connection with this argument, in some ways, I want to say that the considerations on which this worry is based are in some ways very far from the kind of constructivist picture of science on which lots of SSK worries are grounded, right? The constructivist, the SSK picture emphasizes the tremendous amount of room there is to support different kinds of beliefs by the evidence, right? There's a way in which you can think of all the way back line of thought also grows out of Kuhn. And you can think of it as arising in Kuhn in the following way. It's not that our theories aren't supported by evidence. Of course they are. It's that it's complicated, and so there's always lots of evidence, and right, the decision that this evidence supports this theory best or that it supports it well enough, we ought to wait and try to solve this problem rather than throwing it over for another theory. Those kinds of epistemic decisions are open, always open, and complex, and often, very often defensible. And people do, in those kinds of circumstances, people do what it's in their interests to do. That's why SSK is sometimes thought of as a, you know, interest-driven kind of picture of science. And the worry here is very different, but the two can be fit together in a particular way. And that is, if you think we've got this historical pattern of unconceived alternatives, right? It's natural to ask why. And SSK kinds of concerns would be a natural, I think, just part, but part of the story of why, right? Why is it that we are so bad at doing this, right? At finding all the alternatives. One part of that might have to do with the way we're cognitively constituted, the way human beings are built cognitively, but another part might have to do with the way that scientific communities operate and the way that scientific communities do what they do. So let me say two quick things in connection with that.
Sure.
One is I do try in the book at the conclusion of the discussion of individual cases to make a straightforward historical argument that this lack of this failure to conceive of alternative classes of theories applies at the community level with respect to these particular examples, and it's not just about three individual guys, but the other thing I wanted to say, one of the kinds of work that's grown out of this that very much takes up the role for social phenomena is in worrying about whether there's been some variation over historical time in our vulnerability or the how pressing the problem would be. And one of the things that current research is suggesting, I think it is at least not crazy to worry about contemporary science, we're putting much less effort into looking for alternative, fundamentally distinct theoretical alternatives to what we've got now, and partly because of the ways that scientific communities are now constituted and fueled, if you will, in comparison to scientific communities of the past, right? We now have, since, you know, roughly World War II, we have grant-driven science in which, in order to actually conduct science or go test your new idea, you need to convince a panel of experts in the field that it's worth doing and worth the NSF giving you money to do and so on. And that wasn't true in the era of gentleman scientists engaged in the practice for its own sake. So the social elements of the scientific practice are an element of this story, but the kinds of considerations that SSK folks have used to motivate their conclusions really don't come into the way that the argument here is motivated.
Great, thank you. Now, there's a lot more in the book that we are not going to have a chance to get to in detail, but I'll mention for listeners, chapter 6 and 7, sort of after looking at these three very well fleshed out case studies, take up a number of replies by scientific realists to this pessimistic induction that might pose a challenge to the problem of unconceived alternatives that you're giving us. And you sort of show us that these aren't really problems, right? So there's chapter 6 and chapter 7 both look at this in various or various dimensions of potential problems that might be raised by realists with this idea, and you show us, I think, convincingly that they're not really problems. Now, at the final, before we come to the sort of our wrap-up and conclusion, I do want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the final chapter. And this is a chapter in which you're presenting us a way to think about I think about scientific theories without necessarily being scientific realists, but rather from the perspective of something that you're calling epistemic instrumentalism. Now, can you talk about that a little bit? And then I'll bring us to a close here with some more general questions, just because this is something that seems fundamental to what you're doing in this last chapter of the book, and it would be a shame not to raise it for listeners.
Sure, especially because I think this is something that opponents of realism have not typically done in a satisfying way. So the realism debate is usually thought of as this debate between realists and anti-realists. And so there's this other opponents of realism are. That's what they are. They're anti-realists, which is not, I don't think of myself as an anti-realist at all. I think of myself as an instrumentalist, partly for the same kinds of reasons you'd want to say, well, nobody's pro-abortion. People are pro-choice, right? I'm not against, right? The fact that a scientific community has decided there's sufficient evidence to believe in something or that it's our best theory, that's not a reason to disbelieve it, right? That's why it seems to me anti-realism is an inapt name. But also, if you're going to come along and say, ah, well, here's this problem that makes me think our contemporary scientific theories or theories of a particular kind or something like that are not straightforwardly accurate descriptions of how things stand in otherwise inaccessible domains of nature. You have to tell us what you think they are and how they do what they do so well. And so that's what I think anybody who's trying to make trouble for realism, scientific realism, owes us. And it's what I'm trying to provide in the last chapter of the book. And the idea is, right, so there's this long intellectual tradition of thinking of scientific theories, oh, instead of as straightforward descriptions of inaccessible domains, more as conceptual instruments, right? So they are tools that allow us to do particular things. And lo and behold, I mean, one of the things we learned from the history of science is they don't have to be accurate descriptions of how things stand in inaccessible domains of nature in order to let us do lots of instrumentally powerful things. There's been a long tradition of in the philosophy of science of raising trouble for this broad instrumentalist idea, saying, well, it can't work and it's incoherent and right, what do you mean by accept but not believe and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. And so I approach the issue in a little bit of a different way. In that last chapter, I say, look, everybody is an instrumentalist about some theories. Take, for example, Newtonian mechanics. Right? We use Newtonian mechanics to send rockets to the moon. It's simpler than its relativistic counterparts. And at that scale, the differences don't make a difference. Right? They don't matter enough to throw it up. And it's a much handier calculational tool or device for organizing our prediction and intervention about what's going to happen. But everybody needs that sense of instrumentalism, right? Even the scientific realist wants to say about Newtonian mechanics, yeah. No, that's not an accurate description of the way things really stand in nature. But it's a useful tool. It's a useful instrument. Mm-hmm. And in the last chapter, what I try to do is argue that's a model for the view that an instrumentalist can take of all scientific theories, even ones for which she can't tell us, oh, here's the thing I really believe, though. That's why this other one is false and merely a helpful instrument. It's because I know this other thing is true. Even when you don't have the thing that you can exhibit, right? So my position believes that for lots of kinds of scientific theories we have now, there will eventually be some replacement, right? Some even more instrumentally powerful theory. And, you know, at that point, people who are realists about that theory are going to take the same view of contemporary theories that we now do of Newtonian mechanics. But the argument that that somehow the position doesn't make sense or is indefensible or conceptually confused or something seems to me to be mistaken and straightforwardly, demonstrably mistaken, because the coherence of instrumentalism is something we all need. Mm-hmm. Right? Everybody needs, because we all take that attitude about some scientific theories. Mm-hmm. The traditional anti-realist or instrumentalist is just somebody who takes it even towards scientific theories that she doesn't, that for which she isn't able to specify what the alternative thing is that she does believe.
Thank you. Now, there's a ton of stuff that we didn't get a chance to talk about, and I just want to ask you just a few things before we close, and I'll let you go and go on to what I hope is a beautiful day there. We've talked a lot about the use of history, of what we can get out of using historical evidence as philosophers of science. Can you say just briefly a little bit about what can historians learn from this? Sort of what do you hope, if anything, that the historian of science can take from this, or perhaps, you know, more generally, if you have strong opinions about what we might be able to take more from the philosophy of science. So either way, you can either be specific to this book or more general if you feel strongly one way or the other.
Well, it's in a way it'll be both, I guess, and it's connected to what I was saying earlier about wanting to sort of bring the philosophy and history of science back into a little closer commerce than they had before. Or than they seem to have right now. It seems to me one of the sort of professional trends in the history of science is a kind of allergy to generalization or drawing broad conclusions.
Yeah.
Investigations. It's one of the ways in which historians of science show that they're serious and professional, is that they're professionally skeptical. Right. Of any, all generalizations
sort
about
of fetishization of contingency or context.
Right? That's right. Particular, particular. Right. And so, and I mean, this is worrying for the, it seems to me, for the interest of the history of science as a discipline, if, you know, all historians of science ever wind up doing is explaining exactly who said what to whom in the Cavendish lab between these 2 years, and exactly why they decided to change buildings or something. And there's at least a thin generation of historians of science who think that's how all you can ever say, all you can ever generate evidence for on historical grounds. It seems to me if there's something for historians of science to learn from this book, and it's something I'd like to see happen more of in the profession generally anyway, it's that serious, detail-oriented history of science can be put in the service of larger conclusions about the scientific enterprise. And I don't want to suggest by that, I mean, it would be very natural to think, oh, what he means by that is that we can generalize from what seemed to be going on in these three examples he's looked at to all of science. And that's not what I mean. What I mean is, it seems to me that the general pattern I'm talking about, which I try to show very carefully in those three examples, but once you see how it arises in the three examples, it's easy to see how it arises in lots of other historical cases as well, that general pattern, right, creates a problem, not for science, for everything that anybody in a white lab coat ever said, or way of cutting science off like that, but for this particular way of reasoning in science, this eliminative kind of inference that seems so important to our judgments of confirmation for theories, mm-hmm. right? And so what I would want to, so, right, with all the, it's all those qualifications that make it something different from saying, I found a thing that happened somewhere, and now I want you to think it happens everywhere all the time,
sure.
right? That's not the, that's not the way in which I think the detailed history of science really does have something to say and can be brought to bear on broader conclusions about the scientific enterprise as a whole, or how things go in lots of interestingly and importantly unified kinds of cases. I think this serves as a kind of demonstration of that. And it's something I would, immodestly, hope to see more of in the history of science get away from this kind of almost proud professional insistence on not saying anything about anything general.
Almost. Almost proud.
Well, you can say from the inside.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much. One of the things that we have an opportunity to hear a little bit about as we close today, because this is a book that came out originally in 2006, and so the new for the New Books Network is the wonderful availability of a paperback that's given us the occasion to revisit these ideas. Is there anything in particular about the book or about what you are arguing in here that since the publication, either in 2006 or in 2010 for the paperback, you've been rethinking, or you think about differently, or you want an opportunity to sort of to raise for listeners?
Sure. Maybe let me say a couple quick things.
Sure.
One is I'm not fully satisfied with the picture of instrumentalism, especially with the level of detail at which I'm able to paint the picture of instrumentalism in the last chapter. And so I've been thinking more about how the details of working out an instrumentalist view of science go. And I'm working on some very smart graduate students, including a guy not at my own institution but at Pittsburgh named Yoichi Ishida on that. But more broadly and more close to the my own work, so I've made a big deal in the course of this interview about how I really don't mean to be suggesting that this is straightforwardly applicable to everything that happens in science. And I said that in the book, but then went on to write the point of the book was to make the case that this is a real problem. And so I talked about all the places where I think it really does arise. And so part of what I've done in the intervening period is thought a lot more about where I think it doesn't arise and why, what makes that difference. So I published a couple of papers since about what I tried to do is think of a case, the kind of case where I think, look, this just isn't a serious worry. And the particular case I wound up writing something about recently is the case of the hypothesis of the organic origin of fossils, that fossils are the remains of once living organisms. There was a time in the history of science where that was an hypothesis that I think was vulnerable and subject to this problem. There were competing alternative theories. It would have been perfectly reasonable on this kind of ground to say, well, and perhaps the truth of the matter is something we haven't even conceived of yet. But the kind of evidence that we have for the organic origin of fossils has changed. Maybe the simplest example I can give is we now have there's a whole field called experimental taphonomy. And what experimental taphonomists do is make fossils from organic remains in order to study the process and see how it happened, what we ought to expect, and how to infer backwards from fossils to characteristics of organisms and stuff like that. And so what I wanted to suggest with that work is not only, look, this isn't a problem everywhere all the time, all of science doesn't work the same way, the thing to pay attention to, the thing that should guide our yes, we're worried about it here, no, we're not worried about it over there, is the kind of evidence we have for particular sorts of hypotheses. And it's nothing about what the hypothesis says or whether it's about observables or unobservables or who says it or anything. The important thing for deciding whether this is a serious worry is the kind of evidence we have. And the place where it really is where the worry is at a maximum is where the evidence we have is of this, the inference supporting the theory is of this purely of this eliminative type, right? There are other kinds of evidence, and that's one of those other kinds is what we now have abundantly in the case of the organic origin of fossils that we didn't have before. So one way to think about I've probably said too much, but one way to think about what I've been doing since the original publication of the book is trying to figure out having made a case for the problem, I'm trying to figure out what the scope of the problem is and why, because why turns out to be an interesting question all on its own.
That's fascinating. Thank you. Well, we've taken up a ton of your time, and so I want to sort of give you a chance to to get off of Skype. But before we go, because the book is so rich, and because there's so much that we didn't have a chance to talk about that you give us here, is there anything in particular or things in particular that you want to make sure that you mention for listeners that we haven't had a chance to talk about, but that's important in your opinion for them understanding the book, or that you want to? That you want to say for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it?
Well, I will maybe say a little bit more about something that did come up, but that we didn't talk much about.
Sure.
And that is, so one of the things that I touted originally as an advantage, a big advantage of the kind of argument I was making on the basis of history over these more traditional kinds of arguments, the pessimistic induction, underdetermination arguments, was that unlike previous arguments, it did not was not focused on similarities or and differences between contemporary theories and past theories, but on similarities between contemporary theorists and past theorists. And so, why does that matter? Well, there's a sense in which to any use of history, of historical examples, right? To try to show something about present science, always at least always somewhat vulnerable to the, well, that was then and this is now, right? And now our theories have more detailed predictive success, or they predict more novel phenomena or something like that. There's something suspicious about that, and that you want to say, oh, well, we thought the level of success we had before justified believing that theory, and that turned out to be wrong, right? Why shouldn't we think that now too? But you're always open to that kind of counterexample. One reason I thought it was important to focus on unconceived alternatives is what I'm really asserting continuity in is the abilities of theorists to exhaust these spaces of well-confirmed alternatives at a given time. And I think we have a lot less ground for thinking that theorists have changed dramatically since, right, over the course of the modern scientific enterprise than that our theories have. There are all kinds of ways in which current theories are different and more sophisticated and fancier and whatnot than many earlier theories, maybe even all the ones that have been overturned, that don't have corresponding differences in between the theorists who came up with them, the theorists who are coming up with ours. Now, much to my surprise, one line of resistance I got from philosophers of science is, well, maybe theorists really are different now, or at least, more plausibly, that the way scientific communities work now is different in a way that really matters. Maybe we're much better at searching spaces of theoretical alternatives. Right, so maybe the fact that we didn't do this well in the past, it's that was then and this is now all over again, but run with theorists. And so that really got me thinking. There's a quick and dirty response to the worry, which is, yeah, but why should I think that we've been getting better at it all along, why should I now think that we've gotten good enough at it that we've, you know, there's just one or a few left, and so now eliminative reasoning is safe, right, or whatever. But the quick and dirty response seems to me not the most interesting thing to say there. The most interesting thing, what this line of response encouraged me to do was start thinking systematically about the way scientific communities have changed over the course of the modern scientific enterprise. And this is what led me to the line of research I mentioned earlier, comparing the sorts of incentives that are in place and the freedoms that are in place to pursue and develop fundamentally different theoretical alternatives now, as opposed to the middle of the 19th century when science was first professionalized, as opposed to the early scientific communities, the era of the gentleman scientist, in which people, it was very different people doing this, engaged in this activity for very different reasons with very different outcomes. And so maybe ironically or maybe predictably, I've wound up thinking that actually scientific communities have changed in important ways over the course of history, but ways that at least it's not implausible to think make the problem even worse for us. And so that's gotten me interested in the question of whether we ought to be distributing resources for science and organizing the scientific enterprise the way that we are now, this comparatively recent invention following World War II, the success of the radar and the bomb, when this massive state-supported scientific enterprise was put into place, whether that's the way it should be, because it's a way in which science itself has changed over the over its history, and what we're doing right now is an experiment in how to do it. And I think that how to do it actually might make a big difference to how good a job we're doing of considering alternatives or looking for things we haven't thought of yet.
That sounds great. And it sounds like another really wonderfully transdisciplinary project as well. Well, thank you, Carl. This has been great. The book was fantastic to read. It seems really important. And thank you so much for making the time to talk about it today.
You're very kind. And thank you very much for having me on. It was absolutely my pleasure.
My pleasure. You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.